Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One word more for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's Thanksgiving Day, November the 27th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I'm recording this on Tuesday, November the 25th, and I'd like to begin by mentioning that last night I had a pleasure which I've experienced more and more of late, and that is meeting with a new Northwest migrant who was here on his scouting trip. Now, I won't give his name or any details, but he and his wife appear to be completely committed to coming home. I haven't met her yet, but I've spoken with her on the phone, and I can tell you she's completely supportive, which is always a plus. Now, these are exactly the kind of new migrants that we want and need here in our new country. Serious adults with skills and assets who are going into this with their eyes open, not expecting miracles, just people who've decided that something has to be done and that coming home is what that something is, decided correctly. Okay, I closed last week with comments on impending events in Ferguson, Missouri, and also the assumption of openly dictatorial powers in our country by, well, a third world dictator. Both events so far seem to be shaping up more or less as I predicted. Obama annexed the United States to Latin America with the stroke of a pen, and the niggers in Ferguson are in the process of burning down their neighborhood and looting all the stores, including apparently the same convenience store, which the gentle giant robbed back on that day in August before he tried to climb into a police car and steal a police officer's gun. A few new things have come out, including the gentle giant's last words, which apparently were, and I quote, "You too big a pussy to shoot me, motherfucker." Guess again, nigger. Now, the white cop was not indicted, but then there is still the federal civil rights bullshit he has to go through at the hands of the ridiculously misnamed Justice Department. Not to mention the fact that his life has been destroyed forever already. I notice, among other things, that various nigger groups are offering cash rewards on Twitter for the physical location of Officer Wilson and his family. And, of course, nothing has been done about that. Now, can you imagine what would happen if the NF or the KKK did anything remotely resembling any of this? Now, the iron heel of our new American dictatorship would come down with full crushing force. Barry would be signing all kinds of executive orders to send us all to Guantanamo. So far, and I repeat, I'm speaking now about noon on Tuesday, the rioting has remained in the black areas, as I predicted last week, and the niggers have made no attempt to cross over into the white neighborhoods where the wealthy liberals and Democrats live. The whole thing looks choreographed, and so far no one's been killed or seriously injured. Oh, no, wait. I just checked Drudge again, and they found a dead black male in a parked car near where the gentle giant got his black ass plugged, and somebody tried to set the body on fire. And no idea who he is or whether this is in any way related to the so-called protests. It might be just the usual drug-related homicide that you get in nigger slums. It could be that the local gangbangers are using the political disturbances to settle their usual scores. I think what we're seeing here is the resolution of one of the Democratic Party's midterm election plots, which, judging from the results, doesn't seem to have worked out so hot from their point of view. They were trying to mobilize their base for the midterms and make sure that all the niggers trooped to the polls and voted Democrat, preferably four or five times. And so they made all this noise about the gentle giant getting shot in the ass, and now the midterms are over, they're still kind of stuck with it. The liberals and the media set all this up and created all this hullabaloo, and now they have to resolve it somehow. Now, I repeat what I said last week. I predict that there will be a couple of nights of the usual suspects running around in the streets and showing their butts. There'll be some nigger and Korean businesses that'll be burned down, but insurance or taxpayers' money will pay for it all. There will be maybe a couple hundred arrests made, almost all of whom will be quietly released later with the charges dropped, or they'll plead guilty to blocking a sidewalk or something and pay a small fine. And then Ferguson and the gentle giant will disappear from the news cycle as the media moves on to something else, most likely Hillary-related, since from the Democrats' point of view, the 2016 presidential campaign is already up and running. Okay, now, moving on to Obama's open assumption of dictatorial powers on the night of November the 20th. It's kind of hard to say anything that hasn't already been said about that. Now, what disturbs me is that almost no one seems fully to have internalized the magnitude of what happened on November the 20th. This was a really, really big deal, and yet it seems to have been just swallowed up by the images of the chimp out in Ferguson, and indeed it's quite possible that the two events are not unconnected. Okay, Barry has been ruling as dictator de facto for quite some time, ever since he appropriated the power to himself to kill American citizens without trial or any shred of due process in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011. He has especially been doing his dictator thing since he instituted the so-called DREAM Act in 2012, after Congress had twice specifically rejected it. Now, Barry should have been immediately impeached, removed from office, arrested, and taken into legal custody to stand trial when he did that. But nobody had the balls for it, and so he discovered something that I'm pretty sure he's known all along, and that is that he can pretty much do any goddamn thing he wants, and no one's going to do anything at all about it. Now, this whole business for the past 6 years is about the free pass he gets and the complete lack of any consequences for any of the atrocious and illegal acts he commits. Now, what can I tell you? Barack Obama is a nigger, and when a nigger understands that the white man is weak or has abdicated his responsibility and that nothing he does will be punished, he goes wild and he takes whatever he wants. And it's pretty clear that nothing will be done. The Republicans have already said that when they come into Congress in the majority in January, they're not going to impeach him, so what else can I tell you? He's going to have 2 more years to screw the pooch, and the Republicans are just going to stand by, sobbing and wringing their hands. Now, even with a huge majority in the Senate that could theoretically convict the dictator at trial and drag his baby shit brown ass out of that Oval Office, they're too terrified, probably the more so after seeing the burning liquor stores in Ferguson. After all, if they impeach the Kenyan, the niggers might riot. Now, the United States of America came into being on July the 4th, 1776, and it ended on November the 20th, 2014, when Barack Hussein Obama issued what amounted to a royal edict, which changed the nature of this country forever. He did so without even the pretense of consultation with the people's elected representatives. And neither the people's elected representatives nor the people themselves did anything to stop him. Obama not only committed the ultimate violation of the United States Constitution, the very act of royal rule which that Constitution was specifically drafted and designed to prevent on the part of any president, but he violated the much earlier document on which all Anglo-Saxon common law is based, the Magna Carta of 1215, which established the principle of the rule of law in a society where everyone, including the king himself, is subject to that law. Now, we are now ruled in this country by a much older principle that goes back to the Dark Ages. In Latin, it's called volus princeps lex est. The will of the prince is the law. It is fitting that this should happen as we ourselves descend once again into the darkness.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to discuss another book regarding Savitri Devi. This is an interview that took place in the late 70s, and it's entitled Time Rolls On. This turns out to be a very intimate portrait of Savitri. It talks about how she was the only child of older parents and how she studied quite extensively in France and was technically a French citizen because of being born in France. So she finishes her doctorate in France, but decides to ultimately become a Greek citizen because she believes that Greece is small but honorable. And she really hates the French Revolution, but she loves the idea of Greek unity. At first, when she learns about Germany's hope to unify, she sees that as similar to the Greek hope of unity. But as she travels more and studies religion and the Middle East, she begins to see Hitler and the movement as ending what she's going to call Jewish influence, which is defined as internationalism, which is often supported by secular intellectuals who are mostly Jewish. But she has no problem with some Jews who are honest nationalists. Decides after she completes all of her education that she is called to India because of the life-centered philosophy of Dharma, and sees Dharma as being compatible with National Socialism. While in India, she meets a Jewess who is opposed to National Socialism and is told that she is worse than other National Socialists because she believes in the philosophy of the idea and is not in it for any kind of other gain. Now, she ends up in an unconsummated marriage to a Bengali Brahmin. He's a writer of a newspaper. He edits a newspaper, and he is involved in helping the Axis, primarily in Japan. He tells Savitri to go to him who is in reality life and resurrection. In other words, he tells Savitri, you know, you've done enough in India. It's time to leave. It's time to go to Germany. In retrospect, Savitri feels very foolish about deciding to remain in India. At the time, she felt she was being useful in India, and she was helping her husband in terms of gathering information for the Axis and specifically for Japan, and they did help Japan. But Savitri has this hope that Hitler would enter India from the northwest and would be declared a world leader, would be declared world Führer. As things start to go badly with regards to the war, Savitri, of course, gets very depressed, understandably. She starts to visit a lot of various temples, and this is a time in her life where she starts to travel quite a bit. Now, she does travel to England and then goes to France to see her mother. Her relationship with her mother has been somewhat strained. Her mother has totally different political views and was helping the French resistance. At this point, Savitri has a very interesting episode in her life where she seems to have an episode of astral projection. She has this dream in which she gives Goring potassium cyanide. Now, it's true that he does end up committing suicide, and no one knows how he got the cyanide. Now, I don't know whether he had it, whether someone gave it to him, or whether this was truly a serial projection, but it really seems like it if you're ever going to believe in something like that. She ends up in Germany. She goes to prison for distributing literature and posters. She becomes friendly at one point with a fellow prisoner. She is kept out of the political wing of the prison, however, because she is such a firebrand. Now, she is sentenced 3 years, but the Indian government, through her husband, reduces her sentence to 3 months. And she's told to stay out of Germany, but she returns in 1953 and stays until 1957. Now, she's also involved in the Cotswold camp. And this is when she ends up meeting Rockwell. Now, she's impressed with Rockwell in some respects, but she doesn't envy him because of the fact that he was involved in the Second World War on the Allied side because he didn't know. That's his claim. He didn't know. He didn't understand. I'm sure that's true, but and she understands that, but she doesn't envy him. She endorses the NSWPP, and she really believes that Americans should focus on one organization. They shouldn't try to have all these different smaller groups that are only around because someone wanted to be a group leader. Now, she talks about her views of ancient religions, and she talks about how ancient religions were not intolerant. But because there were many small religions, there tended to be less intermarriage between groups, although groups might intermarry if they had similar gods. And she talks about the historical Jesus and really views Jesus as a secular Jewish figure. And she talks about the establishment of Christianity and how she believes that Christianity was really just a way to unify the Roman Empire at a time when it was very large and there was really nothing to unify it. She talks about her admiration for Alexander the Great and Emperor Julian, but of course her greatest love is for Hitler. She talks about how she speaks to various Indian intellectuals, such as Ramana Maharishi and also Sachaveda Swami. They both see him as either some kind of rishi or an incarnation of Vishnu. She's told that it's very good to be a follower of him, but that she needs to detach from any sort of emotion in either way. That is to say, not to be upset at defeat, not to be particularly overjoyed at victory, to have this sort of flat, yogic, advanced non-emotion. And she talks about her attempts at various types of yoga and how she should have been unaffected by 1945, but of course, very few are that advanced. And she talks about how the U.S. is under a lot of race pressure and how in the Kali Yuga, even good things tend to fall. And she talks about making a layer of superior people, and that's something that we've really not done. And she says to study Hitler's life, and she talks about not drinking or smoking, also avoiding meat. And if you're not genetically fit to have children, talking about adopting children and how she would have done that had she been stable enough. However, she was always traveling and never had a steady job. And she talks about giving 1/20th of one's income. She believes in consenting and enthusiastic sacrifice. She leaves us with this question about how after the war, Germany had been given a vote, I guess, to choose form of government and things of that sort. And what if everyone had voted for National Socialism? Now, of course, the answer, she asked this of a German, and the German tells her, well, you know, we would have been occupied forever if that had happened. And I think that's a likely answer. I think that's a rather naive question in some respect. So, I mean, this is a book that you have to understand that Savitri did a lot of traveling and had an extremely varied life. She's always hopping around the globe, going from one thing to the next. And as an elderly woman, this conversation is somewhat like that. But I really found myself breathless at this description of her life. And if you want to have a more intimate portrait of her life, then this is a very good suggestion. So thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
Here's a nice, slow, easy version of an old favorite. This is the Bluegrass Confederacy.
At SeaTac, a town between Seattle and Tacoma that has the international airport, recently voted for a minimum wage of $15 by a referendum. But what we need to do is to learn the history of trade union activity at SeaTac with the baggage handlers, who are the grunts of the airport business. Back in 1971, the baggage handlers were all white. They made $21 an hour, which included medical and pension benefits, according to trade union records. To keep pace with inflation in today's dollars, they would be making about $36 to $38 an hour, similar to what longshoremen are making. The minimum wage of $15 an hour represents a 60% pay raise. Back in the 1950s, 33% of American workforce were unionized. Back in the 50s, 80% of America was white. Today, only 1 in 13 workers are unionized. So why have workers lost their standard of living? The answer is non-white immigration. The white man is a Viking. It means we are all kings. The white man refuses to become a slave. He will not pull a rickshaw. Whereas the other races, such as the Chinese, will allow themselves to be debased so that they will become slaves and pull a rickshaw. Jack London, a socialist, said that the Chinese should be chased out of Canada because they would not support unions or practice solidarity with the white men. However, the Jews, who claim to support trade unionism, the organizer at SeaTac is a Jew named Jonathan Bloomberg, support immigration. And immigration has led to the destruction of white trade unionism. The British disease of trade unionism requires Britons or people similar to Britons, such as white people. Non-white immigrants are scabs, pure and simple. Trade union organizers who support immigration are supporting the destruction of trade unionism. Successful trade unionism requires the workers to fight. Only the Vikings will fight. The other races are too submissive, say like mules, to fight against the greedy employer who want all the money for themselves. There was a peasant rebellion in China under Chairman Mao that did retaliate against the abuses of the working class, but you have to remember the peasantry in China had been oppressed for thousands of years before they retaliated against the ruling class of China. The ruling class of China are like Jews. If they can screw you, they will. The communists exterminate about 60 million landowners and ruling class Chinese. We in this country are suffering from race traitors such as Bill Gates, and Congress is going along with exporting our jobs to foreign countries, and race traitors in the trade unions. The trade union leadership needs to come to realize that not all workers are Vikings. Struggle is the only philosophy that can prevent employers from getting richer while the workers end up getting poorer. Now, how to reach the masses? To reach the masses, you have to be able to explain your message in slogans. The corporations use slogans, just such as, I'm loving it, just do it, etc. We also have to use slogans such as, immigrants are scabs, American work for American workers. In this world of eternal struggle, those that will not fight do not deserve to live. The rich get richer and the poor get poorer because the poor will not fight. If you vote for Jews, who consider you to be cattle, then you deserve to be treated like cattle.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. We're going to do a little spaced repetition. I know this isn't everyone's favorite thing, but there's an uptick in a trend, and it needs addressing. As it happens, we don't exactly thrive on spaced repetition either, because we all, Harold and I especially, know how we sound when certain subjects come up. All that said, We're nothing but honest because we have to be. And therefore, once again, I have to remind you all that we're tasked to capacity up here. And before I really get going, yes, I do know how the party sounds when we start up on this topic. I'm not whining, complaining, or even venting. I'm merely conveying the state of the world as it pertains to the party and our efforts. And because of that, I'm in no way trying to run any of you down or denigrate your suggestions or time spent communicating with the party. In truth, it's quite the opposite, but that's neither here nor there at the moment. That said, it's about time our situation starts to sink in, because I'm quite literally out of patience with some of what's been sent our way. Let me tell you about my month so far. Actually, no. Let me tell you a little bit about October as well, because it's relevant. Mid-October, I needed to spend quite a bit of time taking care of some urgent and unexpected party business with Harold. No, nothing you need to be aware of, and no, nothing bad happened. But that's because I had time, just barely, to take care of things. And it ate most of a weekend, which I needed for other things. I have enough to keep me busy during the week most of the time with basic party upkeep stuff, just like Harold has more than he can handle on a regular basis. I know none of that sounds too bad, but this was almost immediately followed by another standard party function at the beginning of this month. Again, nothing you need to know about, and it was all pretty normal stuff. But it ate most of a weekend. It was, of course, quite worthwhile since I and some others needed to go over ongoing projects, but it did, however, eat more precious time. And wouldn't you know it, the weekend after that was unexpectedly eaten up by another item of party business I was brought in on. And no, I can't just ignore these things, because as we are able to report more and more, people do actually come home and start their own efforts up, which genuinely require the ongoing involvement of senior party associates. And if that wasn't enough, when I got home, there was an email item waiting for me. Someone needed to talk to me about something rather serious, and I spent the rest of the night dealing with that. And then I needed to spend the rest of the weekend making up for lost time on other party small calls. I was forced to give up the rest of the weekend to these things because I had just been informed of the two new migrants to the general area. One of them needed my attention, and, of course, dealing with new people who actually do what needs to be done and come home is going to take higher priority than pretty much anything else, simply because that's the one thing which will prevent the total annihilation of our white race in the coming years. And as it just so happens, right when I'm preparing this material for Radio Free Northwest, I'm in the process of radically reworking my schedule because the party has been made aware of an imminent scouting trip which will have taken place days before you get to hear this. It may or may not work out that everyone who should be involved can be, but that's just how these things go sometimes. Enough about my schedule. I just thought I'd give you all a little insight into those references Harold makes about, quote, things only he can do, unquote. He says that because there's no one else available to do them. Like I said, we're tasked to capacity, and I haven't even gone over the daily small call stuff. But what would prompt me to go over this subject? Well, during the last 5 weeks or so, while we've all been unbelievably busy, the party was bombarded, as it is every so often, with all sorts of suggestions about what we should do differently. This sort of thing makes up about half of all the communications the party receives. The other half, in case you were wondering, is more or less the standard bad news drivel the right obsesses over. Okay, that might be a joke, but just barely. I've only seen a little bit of the email mountain Harold deals with. But suffice it to say, he could do nothing but answer emails full-time, and not process everything he's sent. Periodically, the party is asked why there isn't more action, or why we're not doing something someone thinks we should be doing. There are 101 variations on this theme, but the answer we give is always the same. Firstly, you don't know what we are and aren't doing, so the premise of the suggestion is invalid. Secondly, we're tasked to capacity. If you want to see the party do something, come home and make it happen. Nearly all of the suggestions we are sent are quite good and have plenty of merit to them. Let me remind you again, I'm not trying to run you down, but it's about time this was put to the audience once more. Some proposals made to the party have been given, and will continue to be given, resources and time. These proposals, however, are made by people who care enough about them to come home and convince us we should care about them too. And more importantly, these folks, each and every one of them, never asked us why things weren't happening or tried to tell the party what should be done from thousands of miles away. Suggestions about who to recruit, how to recruit, literature distribution, and fundraising efforts are all well and good, but we simply don't have the manpower. And don't think the party doesn't have short-term goals, either. As an example, one guy who came home a year after I did has all sorts of ideas about literature drops and how to do them safely. We simply don't have the bodies to help him out. Every Northwest Nationalist has a project they'd jump right into if they knew they would have a reasonable chance at success, which usually boils down to having the time and resources to see it through. I'm quite willing to believe many of you have ideas which are just as good and beneficial as anything else we've heard. But here's the thing with ideas. Usually, the people who are supposed to implement them are those who conceive of them to begin with. If you have a plan you say the party needs to adopt, then feel free to set that process in motion yourself. At the very least, please show us enough courtesy to stop backseat political organizing. We are, after all, tasked to capacity. Hail victory, comrades.
Westbound and down, 18-wheels are rolling. Are we gonna do what they say can be done? We've got a long way to go, and a short time to get there. I'm westbound just like a bandit run. If you put hard on the pedal, some hell will mind it breaks. Let it all hang out, cause we gotta run to make.
Greetings, comrades. This is the trucker coming at you from Dodge City, Kansas. Trying to avoid the big cities and stuff. It's Saturday, November 22nd, and next week is Turkey Day. I won't be in the homeland. I'll be out on the road somewhere for it. Not sure exactly where, but I'm on a load from Wisconsin to deliver in Arizona tomorrow. And right now I'm sitting here waiting on a service truck because I've got a bad steer tire on the truck and don't feel comfortable trying to drive it because it's about halfway down to the rim. But I hope y'all are having a grand old time waiting to see if all them niggers and monkeys go and burn down your neighborhood because they're fixing to riot here. Last I heard, the grand jury may be coming out with a decision on Sunday. And I plan on steering clear of any large metropolitan areas as much as possible, especially in Missouri, LA, New York, Chicago, you know, any place with a large dark population. Yep, don't feel like having to deal with it, because supposedly, hopefully the laws will change, where we can be armed in the truck and be able to defend ourselves. Some companies, like the one I drive for, don't allow firearms in the truck. But anyway, so if you're up there in the New York, Great Lakes area and stuff, I hope you really enjoyed that 5-6 feet, whatever it was, worth of snow that they got up there in the Buffalo area. Yep, I wasn't up there for that. I was on a run at that point in time from California to Wisconsin. So I missed out on all that kind of fun stuff. But we don't really have much, especially down in the Puget Sound area. We had some cold temperatures, but we didn't have any great masses of snow. Any high winds, no tornadoes, nothing like that. Just our usual wet and breezy weather. So it beats the sub-zero stuff that I was up there, and yeah, it was still above zero up there in Wisconsin, so I guess you can't really classify that as sub-zero unless you talk to my wife, which she does not like the cold weather. Yeah, it's in the 40s, 50s here, something like that, in Dodge City, Kansas. Clear skies, but it's not the homeland where I'd much rather be right now. Okay, well, this is the trucker. hoping by the time this hits the airwaves that you haven't been burnt out of your neighborhood by the monkeys rioting because they didn't like the grand jury decision in Missouri. All right, comrades, this is the Trucker signing off for yet another short edition.
They say, can't you know? We've got a long way to go and a short time to get there. I'm westbound, just watch your bandit run.
At the risk of starting up the religious wars again, this is Mike Cross doing a couple of gospel numbers.
Oh, thank you. Folks, I hate to say this, but the old energy level has dropped so far that even now I cannot feel below my elbows. So let's sing us a good farewell gospel song here to dance out. It is Sunday night, and it's prayer meeting time. I got a mother in glory land and outshine the sun. I got a mother in glory land and outshine the sun. I got a mother in glory land and outshine the sun. Way beyond the sky. Oh, do Lord, oh, do Lord. Do remember me, yes, Lord. Do Lord, do Lord. Do remember me. Do Lord, oh, do Lord. Do remember me. Way come rolling for to carry my mother away. Can the circle be unbroken? By and by, Lord, by and by, there's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Well, I told that old undertaker, undertaker, please drive slow. You're a holding, Lord, I hate to see her go. Can the circle be unbroken? By and by, Lord, by and by, there's a better home awaiting in the sky, Lord, in the sky. Will I follow to the graveyard? Held my head up and tried to be brave, but I could not keep from crying when they laid her in the grave. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. That fear relieved. How precious did that grace appear the hour I first believed. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch.
I was blind, but now I see. Thank you, good night.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Thursday, October 23rd, 2014. My guest today is Harold Covington. And, you know, Harold, one of the things I look at, I look back historically. I remember when JFK was murdered. And I look at how our society seemed. I was a kid. I was 9 years old. But our society seemed to function better back then. And we lost control after that. We got Lyndon Johnson in, and Lyndon Johnson, in my opinion, was a illegitimate president, as well as every president thereafter. They're all been illegitimate because they all had ties somehow to either the murder or to the cover-up. That includes Nixon, that includes Ford, that includes all of them down to George H.W. Bush, who was on the ground the day at Daley Plaza that Kennedy got murdered. But if I get a virus in my computer and I don't like how it's behaving, what I can do is go back and reset it to a known good point when I knew I didn't have that infection in the computer. So one of my thoughts was, you know, why don't we just try this and let's go back and go to a known good set point. Let's reset all of our laws, all of our protocols, procedures, everything to the way they were the day or the week before JFK got murdered, before he took that bullet. Let's put the executive order in place that JFK signed that makes AIPAC a foreign agent. Let's repeal the Immigration Reform Act of 1965. And anybody who's been naturalized since, and I'm sorry, folks, all bets are off. You got to go home. And let's start deporting these people. And let's get this country back to a known good place. Because you know what? It worked.
Well, that's a very nice, very, very, very nice concept, and I wish there was some practical way to do that. And you know that if you were to go up to the Capitol building and run around the halls of Congress trying to buttonhole congressmen and saying, hey, why don't we do this? Why don't we reset back to 1963? Or if you tried to jump the fence at the White House and go explain it to Obama, you'd simply be arrested and sent to prison or a mental institution. Mike, I'm sorry, we have to live in the real world. And it's a tendency I think we white people have. We really, really, really don't want to do this. We want to be able to just get on with our lives and have a little fun and raise a family. And we want the good life that America always promised us. And we just don't really see, I think, in our own minds, why there has to be all these problems and all this trouble. Why can't we all just get along, blah, 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 blah. But unfortunately, that's not the hand that fortune has dealt with us. Our future, as James Howard Kunstler said, is going to be large caravans of pickup trucks and other vehicles rolling across North America full of armed men who are cutting off heads. One way or the other, that's going to happen. I believe that we need to start taking steps to control that process and make sure that the guys who are carrying the guns in those trucks and cutting off the heads are white and that the heads that are getting cut off are the heads that need to be cut off. We are headed for a time of blood, death, and fire. And it is inevitable, and I really wish to God there was some kind of reset button that we could hit and go back to 1963. It's not happening. And I don't know what else to tell you.
Well, Harold, I understand that, and I know we've got problems. So I hate to see us chuck the whole country. You know, I hate to see this thing break up because, you know what, I remember what it was. And I have another guy comes on now, and I think you know him, Joe Adam, the white voice. He comes on,
yeah.
And he says, forget about the country, Mike. He goes, that's your generation. You guys are hung up on this. We're not. We're young kids. We're practical. We see the deal. We know we can't live in this world. We got to do what we got to do.
Right.
And, you know, part of me is still nostalgic and sentimentally attached to those days. And I see how we've been so misled, and this country has been so malmanaged. I say mismanaged because that implies incompetence, and malmanagement says with malicious purpose. And I believe there's a malicious purpose to taking down this country, and I think a lot of it was because it was a 90% white country, because it was the most productive nation in the world, because it was the most educated people in the world. And people, a certain element around this globe, don't like that. I think it makes the case that we have been under an asymmetrical war, not by a foreign power, but by more of a corporate power, of a financial entity that's out there that didn't want us doing so well,
that, you know, the Chinese, they have communism over there. They'll work for a dollar a day. We're not going to pay any American $18 a day. Forget it. You know, those type of things. And they want to drag us back into a feudalistic system where our people, white people, are erased. And we become part of the mud, you know, part of the coffee-colored future.
Soil of green. A small, pale-skinned, I won't even go so far as to say white, a small, pale-skinned technological and financial elite at the top ruling over a mass of mud-colored slaves. That is our future as they envision it. That's their new world order. And there is only one way we can stop it. We do not seem to be able to organize ourselves in order to do this for reasons which I get into in my own podcast. It has to do with our character or lack thereof. Basically, that's what it all boils down to. It boils down to an issue of white character. We are still strong enough right now so we could put a stop to this tomorrow morning if the white man as a whole in this country ever woke up and decided, okay, we're not going to take any more of this mess. But we won't do it because our people have been so terribly dumbed down and brainwashed and abused by this system and have been made so dysfunctional, and which is another reason why any attempt to recover this entire continent is pretty much doomed to failure, because basically we just don't have the chops for it anymore. You can't wage a continent-wide civil war and expel 150 million people who don't belong here or put them under the ground with a generation of young people who, as James Howard Kunstler said, is hyped up on corn syrup and video games and that sort of stuff. We don't have the character to do that anymore. What we're having to do here in the Northwest is we're beginning this process of migration already. We are bringing those who are salvageable here to make their homes here, make their lives here, and be ready for the day when we can strike for independence, because that day is going to come. Things fall apart. This center cannot hold, as W.B. Yeats said. The United States is going to be no more, and I think it's going to be no more possibly within our lifetimes, because we just can't continue as we are. Something has got to give, and this whole huge rotten house of cards is going to fall when somebody pulls out one card. It could be the EBT system. It could be Obama impeachment. It could be the amnesty by the stroke of Obama's pen. It could be something in the Middle East. It could be Ebola. It could be anything. But eventually somebody is going to pull out that one card and the house of cards is going to collapse. And this is the reality we have to expect. This is the reality we have to prepare for. This is the reality we are going to have to deal with. We need to, quite frankly, stop debating and arguing with one another on the Internet. That is doing no good. Internet is not real. We need to start doing real actions. This is one of the things I keep telling people. Northwest Front is different from any other right-wing or racial group. Membership or association with any of these other movements, such as they are, is all based on something that you say. You fill out a membership application and give the guy $5, or you post to Stormfront or whatever. The Northwest Imperative is based on something that you do. It is deed-based. And the basic act of the Northwest Imperative is the migration of racially conscious white people to the Pacific Northwest. We are starting to have some success with that now. We are finally starting to bring some people here. But this is the reality of the situation we face, Mike. I'm sorry. The good old days, the Brady Bunch days, where America was ours from sea to shining sea, and the days when, that I remember, when I could go out and stay out till 10 o'clock at night running around the neighborhood with my friends and my parents. You know, they just kicked me out the door after supper and said, okay, be back by dark.
Yeah, I remember that.
Nobody can do that anymore, and those days are gone, though.
Well, you know, I'm down here in southern Oregon, which is part of the Northwest as well, and, you know, living in a small town, I can go out in the summertime when it's 8:30, 9 o'clock, and the sun's still up, and the kids out riding their bikes, and it's white neighborhood, clean. It makes you feel a little nostalgic for what this country used
sure.
to be from coast to coast.
That's one of the reasons we advocate people coming in here. The Pacific Northwest is one of the last parts of the North American continent that will remain livable when all else has collapsed. Now, we have a very bad reputation, especially up here on the coast, of being super liberal and super blue and all that sort of stuff. That's Seattle and that's Portland. Outside those urban areas and one or two more slightly smaller urban areas, For example, Eugene has got the University of Oregon there, so it's full of liberals, etc. But other than that, the people up here in the rural areas in the Pacific Northwest are rock solid. The countryside here is 99% white, except if you're near an Indian reservation. And this is still just about the whitest part of the North American continent left, except for certain parts of New England, which are basically private preserves for wealthy Jews and New Yorkers and Bostonians to, you know, retire to. It's where the wealthy elite from the eastern seaboard has their summer homes. Vermont, New Hampshire, western Massachusetts, upstate New York, places like that. Those are still whiter, and I think they're being deliberately kept whiter. But as far as any area where normal people can migrate to and get jobs and build homes, the Northwest is it. We're still pretty much in our 3.5 state area. We're pretty much 90% white statistically overall. And the non-whites are almost totally concentrated in Portland, Seattle, and a few more urban areas. So, yes, there are remnants of the old ways left. People say, well, why don't you go to Kansas or Iowa or someplace like that? Well, for one reason, those areas are landlocked. A new country has to have an extensive coastline with deep water ports. We cannot live in an enclave that are surrounded by hostile territory. We tried that in Rhodesia. I've seen what happens there when you lose your lifeline.
And so, yeah, they did. They just lay siege. And it doesn't matter if there's a castle wall there or not. It's a siege. Nothing gets in. Nothing goes out. And eventually you're left to starve to death or do without critical supplies and components.
That's why we have to have a coastline. The new country has to be large enough for us to grow into, and the 3.5 states we lay claim to fits that bill. So, again, I really do wish there was some way to raise the dead and bring back the America that you see when you turn on Nickelodeon and you watch a Brady Bunch marathon, but we have to understand it's not happening. The clock cannot be turned back, and this continent as a whole is lost to us. Now, maybe once we get our Northwest Republic and the rest of the continent goes to hell in a handbasket, we can do like I mentioned in Freedom Sons, and maybe with a little few brushfire wars, acquire British Columbia and Alberta and Northern California, etc., etc. And it could be that maybe a couple of centuries from now, a few generations from now, the sons that we raise in this new free land of ours will be strong enough and numerous enough to basically kick down the door and take it all back. Maybe. I deliberately have not speculated that far in my books. But
well, first of all, Harold, you know, let me ask a couple of more detailed, more pointed questions. One of them is, what is the critical mass? How many people need to be in the Northwest Territory to create the Republic? What's the population base you need to support this thing?
Give me 1,000 Class A, totally non-dysfunctional, completely dedicated white men and women who will form the nucleus of our group, which I call the Northwest Volunteers. They don't exist yet. These are the people who will be totally committed for life. And 110%, they will live their lives and work all their lives for the Northwest American Republic. Give me those first 1,000 Class A people, and we got it licked.
Okay. Well, you heard him, folks. Only needs 1,000 of you out there, and I know that there's many, many, many people.
Class
out there.
A people, and then
Class A.
Let me put in a caveat there. People who are willing to make what we call TLC, total life commitment. Now, a lot of the people we have coming up here are basically settlers. They're bringing families, they're getting jobs, and they're settling in, and that's good. It was 100 and some odd years, almost 170 something years, I think, between the time the first settlers landed at Jamestown and the time we declared independence in 1775. In the meantime, the colonists had to build their cabins, they had to plant their crops, they had to build their schools and their churches and their communities, they had to raise their children. This went on for generations in the colonial era before our ancestors finally got around to or summoned up the will to rebel against the King of England and become independent. That's probably going to have to happen here. And all these people we're bringing in right now, the majority of them are just basically they're getting jobs, you know, getting homes, and they're just moving on with their lives, which is basically all I ask of them. These Northwest Volunteers I mentioned will be the core of a new revolutionary movement, and they have to be people with a type of human dedication which has not been known among our race since probably the 1920s and the Kampfzeit in Germany. They're going to have to be men and women that our great-grandfathers would have recognized, put it that way. These are very special people I'm talking about when I talk about the first 1,000. if you want to hear more about that, we actually have a party manual as well, which I'll be glad to send you in PDF form.
That's the white book?
The white book, yes.
Yeah, I've got a copy of it. Thank you very much for that as well. I've got another question for you, because, you know, hypothetically, let's fast forward 30, 40 years. Let's say that the Northwest Republic is a reality now, hypothetically. What's going to happen to the rest of this country? How do you see this shaking out? How do you see it developing? What's going to happen to the Southwest, the Northeast, the Southeast?
Right.
You know, what do you see?
Well, I described that in the last of the Northwest novels, Freedom's Sons. Basically, a situation similar to what I mentioned a while ago, the rest of the country will collapse into Brazil at best. It will be a largely third world population. There will probably be other breakaway states or regions. Aslan, the Southwest, will go to the Mexicans. There may be some kind of New Africa or something in the South, or else the blacks will just be so hapless and feckless that the Mexicans and somebody else, the Chinese, are just going to come in and re-enslave them. I frankly, insofar as the black race has a future on this continent, I predict that at some point in the future, in some way, shape, or form, they are going to be re-enslaved. But maybe not. Maybe they'll set up their own little third world dictatorship like Guinea or Senegal or something throughout the American South. I don't know how that'll go. There will probably be in the Northeast liberal belt, like say New England, maybe on down that little coastal strip running down through maybe Philadelphia and then Washington, D.C., a kind of liberal stand or whatever. The Democratic Party and what's left of the United States government will probably hold sway there. That may apply to certain other large urban areas. There will be large sections of what is now called flyover country, where it probably will break up into enclaves of various kinds. There will be a good deal of devolution back to the states. That's one way that maybe some things could be saved or preserved if the federal government, in essence, quietly resigns back to the states the powers that the states were intended to have. Only this, of course, will be just a kind of a rump thing with only about maybe 30 of the 50 states. It won't be pleasant because in addition to all the other the problems involved in our own racial and ethnic troubles, etc., the world economy will be in the toilet. There will be pressure from outside forces. I think 50 years from now, there will be no question that either Russia or China, possibly both, will be the primary superpowers in the world. The United States, well, not even distant third, I don't think the United States will still even be on the map. There may be a kind of a Cold War type situation like we had in the 50s between the Chinese and the Russians as to who will rule the world. So there will be attempts made by both the Russians and the Chinese to make the rump part of the United States a client state. It's got some fascinating possibilities. Canada, I think, will eventually break up as well because the Western Canadians have long been really fed up with being ruled by that shower from Ottawa, and it'll be interesting. 100 years from now, Mike, the world map will look like nothing we would recognize, and the world itself will be nothing we would recognize.
This is Cordelia's dad.
When first I came to town, they called me the Roving Jewel. Now they changed their tune, they call me Katie Cruel. Oh, diddle-a-la-day, oh, little old-a-la-day. Oh, then I was where I would be, then should I be where I am not here. I am where I must be, where I would be I cannot. Oh, diddle-a-la-day, oh, little old-a-la-day. When first I came to town, they brought me the bottles plenty. Now they change their tune, they bring me the bottles empty. Oh, little Lottie, oh, little old Lottie. Oh, then I was where I would be, then should I be where I am not? Here I am where I must be, where I would be I cannot. Oh, little Lottie.
I'm going through the boggy mire, straight way down the road till I come to my heart's desire. Oh, little old day, oh, little old Isle Day. When first I came to town, they called me the Roving Jewel. Now they changed their tune, they call me Katie Cruel. Oh, little old day, oh, the little old Isle Day. Should I be where you're not? Here I am where I must be. Where I would be, I cannot. Oh, little holiday. Oh, little holiday. Oh, that I was where I would be. Then should I be where I am not? Here I am where I must be. Where I would be, I cannot. Oh, little holiday. Oh, little holiday.
Right, it's Wednesday afternoon now, and things in Ferguson, Missouri have gone pretty much as I predicted. The niggers burned some buildings like they said they were going to do, and on the first night, Missouri's Democrat governor seems to have deliberately held back the National Guard and more or less left them to it. I think the theory is if you allow them to let off some steam, it'll be a lot easier to clean up in the long run. The police defended their own station and a few other public buildings the system can't really do without. There was one incident at the courthouse in St. Louis where the Munkoids overturned the barricades and tried to get in, but they were quickly and efficiently beaten back. There is no sign that the niggers made any attempt to move into the nearby white neighborhoods. In the finest African-American tradition, they seem to be just destroying their own habitat, like the great apes, the gorilla and orangutan are among the few mammals that foul their own nest. The homeboys burned down Little Caesars, which will be paid for and rebuilt through insurance money if the company decides they want to bother with it anymore. If not, I guess the colored folks in Ferguson will just have to get their pizza from Papa John's, which is still standing so far, because the other night the manager appears to have done a Davy Crockett number and literally fought off the black mob with a club. I can't get any word on whether the Papa John's manager was white or non-white. Oh, they also burned down the black church, where the gentle giant himself, Michael Brown, and his family attended divine worship. There were also some demonstrations elsewhere around the country by the usual suspects, Acorn and Occupy Wall Street, SEIU, and other flunkies of the ruling party. In New York and a couple of other places, they tried to block traffic, and they were scooped up by the police before they could seriously interfere with wealthy white liberals and Democrats getting home from work or off to their cocktail parties or whatever. The main lesson here, I think, is that so long as the police remain loyal, so long as they stay bought, so to speak, so long as their direct deposits hit their bank accounts every month and they continue to be paid, they will continue to clean up America's messes. Now, barring some sudden escalation like the police or National Guard actually gunning down some more Munkoids, this thing will peter out over the next couple of days and Salon Magazine and the Huffington Post will be proclaiming some great victory. My guess is that at a later date, Darren Wilson will be arrested and tortured and disappeared into the prison industrial complex by the so-called Justice Department on so-called civil rights charges. He will probably be sharing a cell with Cliven Bundy. I think it's about time for the so-called Justice Department to move on him now, after the midterms are over. Anyway, I know you're all occupied with your Thanksgiving activities today, and on Friday a lot of you are going to be swarming to the malls for Black Friday and the beginning of the Christmas consumption season, so rather than close with some inspirational tirade or other, I'll let you go now. Quick question before you go. If Barry only legalized 5 million beaners who are already here anyway with his royal edict on November the 20th, why did the government ask for contract bids back in September from companies to print 34 million green cards? Either they know the number of illegals in the country is much higher than the 5 million or 11 million figure they keep rabbiting on about, or else they're well aware that the 5 million legalized by decree will serve as kind of adult anchor babies and immediately start bringing in their uncles and cousins and mamacitas and 12 bambinos, so forth and so on. Oh, and I understand the California school system is going to institute a policy next year making Spanish language instruction mandatory beginning in elementary school, and the system will be quote-unquote fully bilingual within 10 years. This means, among other things, that teachers will have to accept term papers and whatnot in Spanish. To my knowledge, this is the first statewide adoption of Spanish as the officially and legally recognized second language of the United States. those of us of our generation who don't speak Spanish are, I guess, shit out of luck. Look, guys, I've told you what you have to do about all this. It's simple, it's legal, it's personally beneficial, and it's right. Just do it. Come home. But for now, our time is up for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Well, they fought for poor old Ireland, and full bitter was their fate. Oh, what